Money FM 89.3, best of your money. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
DBS Group Holdings CEO has suggested that FOMO on the stock market is in its early innings and that the lack of appealing alternatives could continue to boost stocks. How are investors reacting to this? Hong Kong's new security law has been labeled as the most important development since the handback of the city to China. How are investors likely to react? Hong Kong markets reopened today following a one-day holiday. It's a perfect time for a check-in. Speaking of check-in, we love it when we managed to connect with Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow, helping us break down what's happening in the markets. Arun, how are you?
I am very good, Michelle. Thank you very much for having me.
All right. Welcome. Listen, DBS came out with that note saying fear of missing out is in its early stages. What should investors take from that? So Chief Investment Officer Ho-Wik Fook in a webinar said that FOMO is in its early innings. There's lots of cash on the sidelines that could find its way into equities, and there is capacity to buy whenever there are corrections in the equity market. So what do you think investors should take from this?
You know, it truly is a big conundrum, right? Like many valid points, obviously, in the report. You have cash basically giving you 0% return. Bonds, maybe, you know, low single, like 1%, 2%, maybe, especially if you're in the investment grade side. Or for that matter, if you're living in Europe, half the bonds that are already in negative earnings territory. So the question then becomes, you know, what's the other asset class apart from those two? Obviously, equities. So you obviously have that tailwind going for boosting equity share prices, which we've very clearly seen with the remarkable rally in the past couple of months from the lows that were hit Feb, March. You have a big new investor class, which is retail investors. On the back of COVID, they have a lot of free time. Massive democratization has occurred because of investing into single name stocks or ETFs with the advent of platforms like Robinhood, Saxo, Interactive Brokers, you name it. Like in the span of 5 or 10 clicks, get your KYC or know your customer done, start up your account, transfer money in, and you're good to start trading. And, you know, it's amazing when a person starts hearing his or her neighbor or their friend have made a 20% return in the span of a couple of weeks investing into bankrupt stock Hertz. Suddenly they decide, oh, okay, this is so easy to make money. Let me also dive in. So, you know, and that's exactly what the fear of missing out is. When other people are making money, you suddenly start feeling that greed comes back into the market. But it is scary, right? Like, look at the number of bankruptcies that have been happening. Just yesterday, I believe, NPC International, which is the largest franchise of Pizza Hut and KFC, they filed for bankruptcy. You're seeing weird things in the market. Hertz was, as I was highlighting earlier, company goes bankrupt. What does the company do next? They decide to, because the share prices are valued six times, they decide to issue a note that, oh, we might be raising $1 billion in equity. Wirecard, same thing. Company files for bankruptcy, yet share price goes up 4 to 5 times from its lows. So we're seeing a lot of these dislocations that are happening, all these blog articles and Reddit threads talking about how buying penny stocks that are bankrupt can very easily double or triple your money in a couple of days and just get out very quickly. That's the key. But it really depends who's going to be the last one holding the bag. So we're seeing all of these conflicting opposing forces where on the one hand, not many good alternatives. You obviously have the Fed put, you have retail investors coming in. But on the other side, there are bankruptcies. You start going into questions of valuations, and the markets are just extremely frothy. What are the options? What are the choices that people have, sadly, yes, right now? Not that many, right? There just is no choice, and which is why we're clearly seeing people jumping into momentum stocks. Tesla is trading at a $210 billion market cap. They just overtook Toyota in terms of market cap yesterday, producing 4% of the cars that Toyota produces. Zoom is at $75 billion, where obviously it's become a household name right now, given the whole working from home. But is the valuation right or not. And I think that's something that a lot of professional investors are questioning right now, I would say. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
In terms of options, we've seen the futures contract for gold topping $1,800 an ounce. First time it's done that in 9 years. It seems investors and analysts are pretty bullish on the precious metal, right?
Analysts and you, I would say, right? If I remember correctly, you're quite bull in gold too.
I have been for 2 years.
but it's, yeah, so definitely. You know, it's a great hedge against, be it equity, be it bond, potentially inflation hedge, as it has been for like over 100 years. A lot of professional investors have definitely gone into this space because just because of the lack of alternatives.
Exactly.
So it kind of goes in both places, right? So if the world goes complete, if there's a massive second wave of COVID, where do people put their money into? Then it suddenly becomes like a currency hedge. On the other hand, if things start improving, but you still have extremely low interest rates leading to eventually to inflation, where do you start putting your money into? Gold. So it becomes an interesting barbell strategy. So it makes sense for a number of investors to have at least some exposure to gold in their portfolio.
Okay, so for investors who want to put risk back on the table, help us understand some of the instruments. The Singapore Exchange has said it is introducing a futures contract on the FTSE Taiwan RIC Capped Index, enabling investors to gain exposure, they say, to a broad representation of large and mid-cap Taiwan stocks. Help us understand what this means for investors.
Sure. So, you know, we've talked about the whole MSCI index going away from the SGX exchange and them moving to Hong Kong, which obviously let a lot of investors in Singapore or having access to the SGX exchange at a loss of alternatives where if they don't want exposure only to the Singapore market, which in all due respect, it is quite small, and they want exposure to other larger economies, how do they go about achieving it? You know, smart move by SGX. This is exactly what they were stating when MSCI was made the decision to take away its suite of products. They want to start coming up with their own. So, from an investor's perspective, if you want exposure to Taiwan, which is obviously extremely, it has a large number of semiconductor companies and on the higher technology end of the spectrum, you're able to purchase an index. Which is just one single underlying. You can just purchase that via the SGX and thereby getting replicated the returns of what the Taiwan exchange does. Very similar to an MSCI product. It's released by SGX by itself. So hopefully we can start seeing SGX share price rebound with more and more churn or more and more trades that are happening with SGX trying to come up with other similar country-type ETFs, other similar industry or sector type ETFs to attract investor attention.
Makes a lot of sense. Thank you for helping us out there. Now, the greatest challenge of the market for many market players is trying to time when there'll be a pause or some sort of corrective action or understanding how geopolitics ties in with economic activity. So if we take a look at India-Chinese relations, for example, they seem to be on the down. There's banning of apps, cargo stuck at ports across borders. The rise in tensions along the China-Indian border in the Himalayas began back in early May and resulted in bloodshed earlier this month. If we take a look at specifically the banning of the apps, I understand India's banned 59 apps from China. India is a major market for these Chinese apps. So some observers say this could be the end of China's digital Silk Road. From an investor's perspective, what does this mean for Chinese companies, the app companies' valuations? I mean, don't social media companies depend on reach as a major indicator and in order to gain more investment?
I mean, to begin with, you hit the nail on the head in terms of when politics gets involved in the economy, things start becoming very, very difficult because uncertainty spikes up. And with uncertainty spiking up, the range of eventual outcomes obviously becomes really wide. And for a prudent investor, you need to start taking a much larger margin of safety against the valuation of the company before you can get comfortable in purchasing it. Social media, apps, spot on. Obviously, the whole business model of social media companies revolves around having a massive user base and trying to monetize it by not telling the consumer to pay, because, you know, obviously no one's paid a cent as a consumer on Facebook for creating an account or something over there, but they monetize it from businesses. And it becomes, and the advantages or disadvantages go in both ways, right? Because you get a lot more users, thereby having a lot more companies coming on your platform to advertise to those users, and thereby that the flywheel can move in the right direction. Of course, if it starts going the other way and people lose faith in the platform, then immediately there'll be a massive exodus of companies leaving it. I mean, who's heard of like MySpace and ICQ, like the pioneers of social media? Facebook came over, had a massive spike up in terms of number of users, and the rest is history, as they say. TikTok, taking a look at numbers, 611 million users of TikTok just in India. 5.5 billion hours were spent by the Indian diaspora in India on TikTok's application. If you are a company looking to get your brand out there, looking to market a product, you know, that obviously becomes one of the biggest channels, especially with the dying of the traditional network. It becomes the biggest channel for brands to advertise on. Now, suddenly you have the Indian government on obviously a very politically motivated move, suddenly just stopping it and then coming up with an Indian alternative. I forget the name of that, which has now become like the second largest download on the Android app ecosystem, Google Play, basically, in India. Because it's Indian created or something like that, right? Even though that's another whole story altogether, because apparently the source code was from Pakistan, and that's another whole political nightmare altogether. But anyway, so you have this case where now, how does TikTok go about trying to appease to its investors that, you know, basically half or one third of their user base is now going to be shut out because of political reasons? Right. You just can't do anything about it. And that will lead to a correction in social media valuations, where if the world suddenly starts becoming a lot more nationalist and, you know, China's obviously banned Facebook and Google and all of that, India's trying to come up with its own locally developed platforms similar to Facebook or TikTok and whatnot, the whole industry segmentation happens. And then what does the company have to do? If I'm like Unilever or Coca-Cola or something, I'm going to start spreading my wallet size across to all these different platforms because I don't want to get affected because of a decision that one government makes in one country. And that will naturally lead to, you know, lower valuation.
Yeah, I can't imagine TikTok, Hilo, WeChat suddenly banned in India. And all these users, I can't imagine, what are they going to use now? I guess they're forced to the alternatives that are Indian-made, huh? That's the whole idea. Like,
I mean, it is. That's what the Indian government wants. But just taking a step back, not from an economic perspective or not from an individual share perspective, I'm pretty sure that those 5.5 billion hours can be spent a lot more productively than looking at cats dancing or, you know, like some random shopkeeper dancing and trying to sell his product.
So, I agree. Read a book, people. All right. Speaking of social media, a lot of investors have Facebook or, you know, some of these FANG stocks in their portfolio. So what do you read, you know, when you see brands like Unilever, Pepsi jumping on the bandwagon, pulling their ad dollars because they want to take a stand against hate speech? What do you think the implications of this are on stock prices?
I mean, it's huge, right? Like when this was announced, when Unilever decided to pull its plug on Facebook for at least the rest of the year, the share price was down like 7 or 8%. You know, billions were lost in investor money and obviously Zuckerberg's net worth. They are in a spot of bother over here. This is my personal opinion, obviously, but you have, where did it start off with, right? Like on an internal person's, on an internal company's perspective, you have had a number of employees staging walkouts, not being comfortable with, you know, what the company stands for, which is exactly why they joined the company. And we touched upon this, you know, last week, I think, where many of these tech companies are California-centric. You have these employees who think that they, you know, they join these companies to try and change the world. And lo and behold, you come into these places and it's just yet another large company that is only looking at profits. So you have a lot of internal discontent, I would say, in terms of employee morale. Then it went external too, where a lot of questions of data privacy started being asked. You know, I'm sharing all these pictures, I'm doing all of this content. Is this safe? Is it not safe? Am I getting paid for it? And, you know, then you started having, obviously, like these YouTube stars, influencers on Instagram starting to get paid for their content and what they do. But then now you have the last, the final straw, I would say, where the advertisers, the engine behind how these social media companies make money is they're happy to try and spend as much money as they want trying to acquire users on their platform just to ensure that because of those eyeballs that are there, you will have large companies spending ad dollars on their platform. But given what is happening right now, they need to make a stand. But that causes a lot of issues also, right? Like, it's not easy for a social media company to try and stifle freedom of speech in the U.S., for example. It becomes a very political, thorny issue, which social media companies might not be be able to manage. And that leads to regulation, and regulation leads to massive increase in costs, operating costs, which leads to a massive squeeze in margins. So I think this can actually become a lot bigger, or it can increase in size in terms of the effect that it can have on social media companies and how they survive in the long run, how much regulation comes into this space. Right now, Twitter is trending really well because they, you know, they flagged President Trump's tweets as, you know, promoting violence, etc. But then who's to know what kind of regulation is going to come up in the U.S., which Trump might start off just to try and clamp down on Twitter's popularity now. Will he move to another platform? And thereby leading, you know, 100 million people to suddenly start deciding to boycott Twitter. So it's a very thorny issue now where, you know, a lot, you can split the U.S. population at least in 50-50 in terms of who all are happy with freedom of speech versus not, and how will social media companies tread this very politically sensitive path. That's going to be the big question mark. And I don't think anyone has the answer to that yet. So there is definitely a lot of uncertainty in that space.
He helps us think like pro investors. Arun Pai is Chief Strategy Officer at Flow. Help us understand how to trade China's tightening grip on Hong Kong. We know that China is introducing new laws. This could impact Hong Kong's role as a financial hub and also bridge the mainland and the rest of the world. So what does this mean for markets, and are there opportunities for traders here?
So I'll probably address that in two ways. Firstly, in terms of absolute valuations, the Hong Kong market is definitely one of the more attractive ones as compared to the rest of the world. With a tailwind of a number of high-growth technology companies having secondary listings in the Hong Kong exchange, there can be there will be a lot of investor interest. So you got, you know, that going for it. On the flip side, though, and sadly, investing is always a game of trying to, like, evaluate both risks and rewards and seeing which one counts out. On the other hand, massive political issues, right? The whole high degree of autonomy, the phrase that the U.S. is trying to hold Hong Kong to, claims that it's not right now, given the new laws that have taken place. China does not seem to be backing down anytime soon. Their message is very clear. This is one country. We will deal with it how we choose to. We do not want any external influence in the space. In terms of numbers, though, it's interesting where the U.S. might actually be affected by this, because they are currently running north of $30 billion trade surplus last year. So if the U.S. really decides to start banning you know, these kind, like, high technology transfer. Right now, high technology transfer or companies requiring this, a thing called a special license, is only 1.2% of the goods that Hong Kong imports from the U.S. So in terms of absolute numbers, it's not, you know, it's not a doomsday scenario just yet. But it can be clearly seen on both sides of the spectrum. The rhetoric is increasing. The number of actionable items of, you know, like these kind of high-tech, high-technology solutions and hardware is not going to be sold to Hong Kong. Visa restrictions have now come up, where the U.S. is saying various Chinese officials who were responsible for this saga in Hong Kong, they will not be given visas. So there is that issue coming up. From China's perspective now, Hong Kong was at 45% of exports in 1992, so going back like about 30-ish years, 45% of exports were going into China. Now that number has dropped down to like 12%. But it's become more of a nationalistic pride, and having Hong Kong not being told by external influences as to how China should be able to run its own country. Because, you know, now obviously China is the second largest economy in the world. They should have a say in the world economy. So they're not going to back down that easily. And the U.S. evidently is not backing down either, which is just going to lead to a lot more political issues in for investors especially.
Yeah, that's a big picture. I mean, yes, just yesterday, more than 300 protesters were taken into custody in Hong Kong, several charged under the new national security law that we've just been talking about. Meantime, today, the Hong Kong markets reopened following a one-day holiday, trading up 1.6% at 24,814.7. If we take a step back, big picture, though, do you think these new measures are going to bring stability? Could they bring capital flight, possible brain drain?
I think in the long run, from a political aspect, like this was eventually going to happen anyway, right? The timing is just a bit concerning, I guess, for an investor who potentially might have a slightly shorter time frame in mind. You've got the COVID crisis going on. You've got U.S. and China locked in a trade war. Is it really that essential to bring small, poor old Hong Kong in the middle of this massive fight?
Mm.
Not. But maybe this is China's way of exerting more influence and having a showing a stand to the rest of the world and to its own internal people. You know, it's a great populist measure, obviously, right? Like it can do well, even though China might not be a democracy, mm-hmm. they still are very concerned about how the local population looks at the government. And this is definitely a very sensitive local topic that can earn Xi a lot of favors from its his local population. So from that perspective, I guess the timing makes sense from obviously the government in China's perspective. But from an investor's side, yes, it's scary. Taking the long view of investments over here,
mm-hmm.
You know, taking a step back exactly. Like, why should this immediate political issue bother them that much? You have a number of really good quality names who will not be willing to take the risk of only having a U.S. listing. They will decide to do a secondary listing in Hong Kong, or maybe it could even convert to a primary listing in Hong Kong. Who knows? You have a number of the North-South connect, which leads to a number of Chinese investors now coming into Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole Bay Area wealth management plan that's come up, where a number of counties, I guess, or like smaller jurisdictions in China will now have access to the kind of wealth products that Hong Kong citizens, very similar to Singapore citizens, have access to, which will mean a lot more users, a lot more retail investors. And we've seen, right, like if you look at the U.S. stock exchange,
mm-hmm.
retail investors have really pumped that index up substantially, yeah. along with the Fed. Who's to say that China's not going to be the same?
Speaking of retail investors, so nice way to end where we started, basically. Yesterday, I did a show on a new instrument that people could use to invest their CPF funds in. We were talking about these new passive index funds. And I just wondered if you could explain to the absolute beginner investor what a passive index fund is to begin with.
Sure. In investing, there are two segments, very broadly speaking. You have active investing and passive investing. Active investing is kind of like what we are discussing about right now. You know, you try and pick individual stocks. You try and pick, okay, I think Hong Kong market looks relatively cheap. Let me take an exposure into that. Tesla, I think, is overvalued. You know, I've been burnt shorting it, so I'll stay away from it, etc. So you start going into the nitty-gritty of individual companies or individual sectors, etc. When it comes to passive investing, it's a very clear-cut, rule-based strategy of investing. So a passive investing could be something as simple as the S&P 500 is an index of the 500 largest market capitalization companies in the U.S., listed in the U.S. So as a passive investor, I will just take a certain amount of money, invest it into the S&P 500, and because of certain rules that exist within that ETF or within that fund, me as an investor has a very clear idea of where my money is going. As compared to, say, if I take my money and invest it into a hedge fund, sure, get lucky and that the fund manager of the hedge fund is like a Warren Buffett or Charlie Munger or someone, or it could just, you know, not even beat the market benchmark. So that's the big difference. Active investing obviously is a lot more expensive because you want to pay the inflated fees of the fund manager who thinks that he or she can beat the stock, the market. Mm-hmm. As compared to passive investing, where the fees are extremely low, it gives investors a fantastic opportunity to get exposure into the market, again, for the long run, not for take my CPF money, which is obviously, you know, for my retirement savings, mm-hmm. keep it in the market for like 30, 40 years or 20 years, and just keep investing into it in a slow and steady manner, and then just take the benefit of the growth in the world in general. And in 20, 30 years, you will definitely do just fine.
But there are differently managed passive index funds, right?
Yes, there are. Each passive fund will have its own certain rule. You could have even something as small as a semiconductor ETF or a semiconductor fund where they pick, the 10 largest semiconductor companies in Asia. So it can go as broad as, you know, the 5,000 largest market capitalization companies all the way down to a very microscopic, I will invest only in REITs in Singapore. So, and you have a whole vast variety of instruments. Again, the idea here is not to think that it's passive because this is a semiconductor ETF. Oh, because it's passive, this is safe. That's not the case. It's the advantage of a passive investment fund, which is largely diversified, means that a typical retail investor does not need to pay too much attention to it. Mm-hmm. Take a broad basket of stocks through a passive fund, know the rules of what it is, and just let it run. Because a great example, and we talked about this when oil went negative, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of people had invested into the oil ETF, mm-hmm. thinking that, oh yeah, this is, I'm just buying the underlying, all is good. But it was not, because the rules were very clearly stated that you're going to be buying only the front month future, which, you know, can go negative theoretically, and we actually saw it in practice a couple of months.
Yeah, so it's not a savings account. It's still investing. There's still risks involved. Thanks so much for helping us there, Arun. That was great. Thanks for joining us this morning. Arun Pai, Chief Strategy Officer at Flow in Money and Me. Have a great day, Arun.
Thank you. You too, Michelle.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.